All right, so this is Jennifer Blimquist and Bob Joyner, and Bob is a longtime resident of DeKalb County. So, Bob, let's hear your DeKalb County, let's hear your story.
Okay. The story started in Savannah in May of 1941. My mom would tell you that she was pregnant with me when Dad's work took him temporarily to Savannah. I was born in Telfair Woman's Hospital. Building's still there. It's now a senior center. And moved back to Atlanta when I was 5 months old, I was told. Lived in DeKalb County from 87 to 90, and then from 95 until today. Grew up on the southwest side of Atlanta. Been to three schools in my life: Ben Hill Elementary, Southwest High School, and North Avenue Trade School. Some people call it Georgia Tech. Career was 50 plus years in information technology. Army National Guard veteran from the 60s. And that's about it, chronologically. Ben Hill Elementary was in Ben Hill, Georgia, which is just outside the perimeter on State Route 1, Georgia 166, Greenbrier Mall area. Southwest High School is now, I believe, Benjamin Mays Middle School on Sewell Road, if that has not been renamed, at the corner of Sewell Road and Lyndhurst in southwest Atlanta. And, of course, Georgia Tech is where it's been.
And you went to Georgia Tech, you said, before or after it was called Georgia Tech?
Oh, WGST radio station. That's W because it's a radio station east of the Mississippi. Georgia School of Technology, WGST. At one time, it was a 50-watt radio station by the Georgia Tech electrical engineering students when it originally got its license, and then later it became an independent radio station and still is, for that matter. But it was originally Georgia School of Technology, then it became Georgia Institute of Technology, and somewhere along the line, I don't remember the dates, it became a full university with many colleges. And of course, the history of Georgia Tech can be looked up just about anywhere.
So what years were you at Georgia Tech?
Started 10 days out of high school, graduated from high school, and started summer quarter in 1959. Was a full-time student until 62, ran out of money. Started working on campus in a Georgia Highway Department research lab. Later these days, Georgia Department of Transportation, DOT, got into computers that way, went to night school, eventually went to work for AFIS, that's acronym for Army and Air Force Exchange Service. They run the Army PXs and the Air Force BXs all over the world. You're a government employee, but you're not paid tax dollars. It's a self-supporting institution. And they transferred me to Texas. So in 1966, moved to a suburb or outside a suburb of Dallas called Lancaster, Texas. Not Lancaster. It's Lancaster. Happened to be spelled the same way, but it's like Houston and Houston.
Yeah, so they'll correct you if you go to Lancaster.
They will. And lived out there from 66 to 70. My daughter was born there. Moved back to Atlanta. Worked for CNS Bank for 2.5 years. And then Computer Management Incorporated for 12 years, I guess. Let's see, after that, moved to Management Science America, which became Dun & Bradstreet Software. Left there and went to Phoenix Consulting, Inc., commonly known as PCI. From there to Equifax, and from Equifax to IBM, and then retired from IBM at age 69.
Would you want to talk a little bit about your mom and dad, your brother, and like your parents and what they did, and your brother and where he went to school, and that kind of part of your history?
My dad was a native Atlantan. My grandfather, as an 8-year-old, he and his family moved from Columbia, South Carolina to Atlanta. I think my great-grandfather, as the family story goes, he was a hotel manager across the street from the South Carolina State Capitol until it burnt to the ground.
Oh.
And so then he came to Atlanta along with my then 8-year-old grandfather.
Yeah.
An interesting aside, which will have meaning in a little further along in the story. My grandfather at the time worked for the Postal Telegraph Company. You've probably never heard of it. It was a competitor to Western Union Telegraph Company. And there's a plaque in the family Bible or a certificate that they held an annual competition. And one year he was the second fastest receiver in teletype and the third fastest sender in the entire nationwide postal telegraph company. So they asked him to go to Kansas City, Kansas temporarily for 6 months to teach telegraphy.
Okay.
There he met and married Gladys Scott and moved her to Atlanta, Georgia, and those were my paternal grandparents. They had one son, Robert Joyner Sr., my father, who went to, really don't know where he went to elementary school, somewhere on the southwest side of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Boys High, high school,
yeah,
and then Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
And
we have some Boys High School yearbooks here. I have to look your dad up, see if
I'll
he's in
see
there.
If you can find him.
Is it in Stone Mountain or Decatur? I think there was...
This was on North Avenue, literally across the street from Georgia Tech.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe
if
we don't have that one.
Correctly.
But I think Decatur had a boys high school.
Yeah, with all high schools.
Stone Mountain,
were segregated by
gender.
Sex.
Yeah, okay.
By gender.
Cool.
Then he ended up working for U.S. Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
Chased bootleggers for a living. A lot of interesting stories secondhand there.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1937, he was working for Goodyear Rubber Company.
Mm-hmm.
And as a small child, I pictured my father's profession as going to door to door selling leather men's belts, because I'd heard he was a belt salesman.
Yeah.
But what he sold were the huge machine belts used in factories.
Oh.
And once a year, he would spend 3 or 4 months wandering around the Southwest calling on Goodyear customers and their factories. Well, one day in 1937, he helped a young lady who had been bruised and battered in a car wreck off of a city bus in the middle of the night in Oklahoma City.
Hmm.
Told her that a southern gentleman couldn't leave a lady in her condition on the side of the road, and could he accompany her anywhere?
Hmm.
And so he walked her a couple of blocks to her apartment. She was an emergency room nurse. Before he said goodnight, he asked her out on a date, and she said yes. And 10 days later, on their third date, he asked her to marry him. She said yes and had to tell the doctor she was engaged to, thanks but no thanks. They got married in the courthouse in Oklahoma City. And he went on his routes around the Southwest, and she went back to work being a nurse. And then one day she got a telegram that said, pack your bag and go to the Oklahoma City train station. There's a ticket waiting for you, and I'll join you when the train stops in Little Rock, Arkansas, and we'll go home to Atlanta.
Wow.
And they did. So my grandfather met a young lady on short notice in Kansas and married her and brought her to Atlanta, and my father did the same thing except an Oklahoman.
Yeah.
My mother's people were all wheat farmers in the state of Oklahoma. My maternal grandfather as an 18-year-old and my great-grandfather, they came down from their farm in Kansas and homesteaded in northwest Oklahoma on the Arapaho land rush in the early 1890s. They staked out a claim. You had to live on it for either 2 or 3 years. Could be in a tent, but you had to live on it. You had to produce crops. Might just be a vegetable garden that you lived off of, but you had to produce crops. And after you had lived on it, either 2 or 3 years, I don't know which, you could then buy the land for 25 cents an acre.
Huh.
And so you bought what's known as a quarter section. That's 160 acres. A section is 1 square mile, and there's 4 quarter sections in a section.
Okay.
In the state of Oklahoma, at least as of a few years ago, they're called century farms, but they are original homesteads from whatever homesteading opening it was, land rush they called it, that are still in the same family.
Wow.
And are still a working farm, and a member of the original family lives on the property. And as of 10, 15 years ago at least, there were only 18 in the whole state of Oklahoma that meet those criteria, and our family farm, the Slatt family farm, is one of them.
Is that right?
There's a historical marker out at the road that says it's one of the centennial farms.
That's amazing.
And now the daughter, I guess she's retired now, but the daughter of a first cousin lives in the farmhouse that my mother was born on. She was a nurse in Oklahoma City. O'Keen, Oklahoma is 90 miles from Oklahoma City. And she works her shift, whatever week it is, in Oklahoma City and lives in her apartment, or she did. I think she's fully retired now. And then came back to the farm for her weekends.
Oh my goodness.
And my first cousin, farmed the original homestead. He is the 1, 2, 3, 4th generation to farm that land, and his grandson, the 5th generation, doesn't live on it, but he does farm it.
So what do they farm? What's the crop?
It's primarily winter wheat.
Okay.
Most American wheat is winter wheat. It's planted in the fall and harvested in the spring. And then during the summer, you let the land rest or plant some other crop.
Yeah.
My grandfather and my uncle would often plant oats to help feed the cows and all, or any crop, cattle fodder, to feed the dairy cows during the winter. Hay, whatever. I worked my 4 high school summers on my uncle's wheat farm in outside O'Keen, Oklahoma. So that would be summers of 55, 56, 57, and 58. The first time I did that as a 12-year-old, my 7-year-old brother in tow, Mom and Dad put us on the train. We rode the train to Memphis, got off the train, waited 5 to 6 hours in the Memphis train station, and got on the train to Oklahoma City, and their relative would pick us up.
Yeah.
And each summer, either we'd ride the train one way or the other, going out or coming back. And the other end of that, Mom and Dad would drive to Oklahoma, which was our annual vacation, was always going to Oklahoma, so we could all see Mom's relatives.
Yeah.
We rarely went anywhere else for a vacation as I was growing up. Maybe a long weekend to the beach or the mountains.
Yeah.
But the 2-week vacation was always to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Had a younger brother, Jimmy, 5 years younger than me. We were the only 2 kids in the marriage. And he went to Ben Hill Elementary, started high school as an 8th grader, no junior high in Atlanta at the time, at Marist,
mm-hmm.
which then was a all boys, purely military school, right downtown.
Mm-hmm.
The Marist campus is now a surface parking lot behind SunTrust Plaza, next to the Catholic Church there.
Oh,
it didn't move to where it is now, the modern campus.
Yeah.
Until, gosh, I don't remember.
Hmm.
Have to look it up. But Jim went to school there for 1 year, and then my father was transferred to Washington, D.C. to be coordinator of all special agents for U.S. Treasury and assistant director of the School for Treasury Agents. In those days, there really were no law enforcement degrees yet available.
Okay.
So if you applied to become a special agent with Treasury, FBI, Secret Service, any of the rest, you either had to have an accounting degree or a law degree. And because my father didn't have either, as I was growing up, in addition to being an active member in the U.S. Army Reserves, he went to law school at night to get a law degree at Woodrow Wilson's Law School.
Yeah.
Woodrow Wilson's something.
School of Law or something.
School of Law, which had a campus here in Atlanta.
Yeah.
It was named after the former president.
Yeah, it was downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
But Dad went there and got his law degree.
Cool.
He said he didn't feel like he could be the director of a school that required a law degree or an accounting degree without having one himself, so mm-hmm. he went back to school and got one.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in D.C., except for during the Berlin crisis, his reserve unit, which met at the Pentagon, was activated, and they went to Washington State for a year, to Fort Lewis, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Mom, Dad, and my brother. I was a student at Georgia Tech, so I just kept on going to school. And lived out there for a year, then came back to D.C. In 65, Dad had had enough of Washington, D.C., so he requested a transfer to a field office, and they sent him to Jacksonville. But at that point in time, that's when his malignant brain tumor came to light, so he never really worked in Jacksonville.
Mm.
But they lived down there when the brain tumor was found by exploratory surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
Mm.
Days before MRIs and CAT scans. They gave him 6 months to live, but he lived 18 months and had his full faculties almost the whole time, but died in Jacksonville and is buried in the family plot in East Point, Georgia.
Okay.
My brother volunteered, lied about his age, and volunteered for the U.S. Army real early. Told Mom and Dad at a family dinner, supper in Virginia, "Oh, by the way, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, I need to be in Baltimore." "What for?" "I'm going in the Army." "You're not old enough to go in the Army." "Well, yeah." So Dad put on his Lieutenant Colonel's uniform and took him to Baltimore the next morning and straightened out his date of birth and signed the necessary paperwork for him to go into the Army.
Oh, wow.
He served 2.5 tours in the U.S. Army as a volunteer. He was a military policeman, crew chief on helicopters, like his big brother, and ended up in Germany, and then one day got mad at the U.S. Army for reasons he never shared, and went AWOL to Sweden and married a Swedish girl. Got amnesty from the U.S. government in the mid-70s when all the draft dodgers and people that ran away to Canada and et cetera got amnesty.
Mm-hmm.
And drove tractor trailers from Sweden to Saudi Arabia and back for 20 plus years. Had terminal wanderlust. He had to be outside and he had to be going.
Mm-hmm.
Married a Swedish girl, have two wonderful kids. My Swedish kids now, since he died in a plane crash in Sweden in May of 1990. And so I have Robin's my niece, and Rick is my nephew. They both are dual citizens, U.S. and Swedish. Mm-hmm. And Rick and his wife worked in the United States 2006 and 2007. They were in Jacksonville. Their daughter was born in Jacksonville. 2008 and half of 2009, they were in Oklahoma City. The rest of 2009 and 2010, they were in Chicago. And then they ended up going back to Sweden, where they now live. My brother was a character to know. He literally had an IQ that was off the scale on the high end, and was constantly flunking out of school because he just wasn't interested. A counselor in the high school in Arlington, Virginia, finally found his hot button. He said, "Jimmy, if you keep failing, I'm going to have to hold you back a year." And the next day, he went to making straight A's. Okay. And didn't make straight A's until he pulled his average up to a high C, and then go back to failing. And when it dropped to a D, he'd start making straight A's again. And but he never graduated from high school, since he volunteered to be in the Army by lying about his age by 6 months. And did get his GED in the U.S. Army. Probably the most well-read person I've ever known, and could discourse on any subject you wanted to discuss. Just had an insatiable curiosity that he scratched usually by reading in the days before the internet. But one of those characters.
Yeah.
Never in serious trouble, but always in trouble.
Speaking of trouble, do you have any, I feel like there's so many, but do you have any one story or two stories about your dad's work in the Treasury and chasing bootleggers, since you mentioned it earlier?
Yep.
Do you have any that's kind of stand out in your memory?
Number one, I guess, is my lifelong interest in automobiles and racing, because I learned to drive in a hot rod Ford that my dad had built, because the government wouldn't give him any car that could catch anything. So we had our family car was a 1951 Ford. The dad had put a hot-rodded 53 Mercury engine in, and that's what I learned to drive in. Dad often left for work in disguises. He worked undercover a lot, not just on bootleggers, also on illicit gambling. The U.S. government doesn't care if you gamble, if you run a gambling casino, even though it was illegal in Georgia. They didn't care if you ran a gambling operation, but they care a whole lot if you didn't pay taxes on your winnings. And so that was how they would go after him. So he worked on what was known in the 50s as the bug racket. It was a betting process. Numbers racket, it was also called. And so he did most of his undercover work when working on that. However, I remember in early elementary school, accompanying my mother and brother to the North Georgia County Jail, where my father was in jail as a driver for a bootlegger. He did that undercover and found out the head bootlegger was the local sheriff, and that's how they built the case against him.
Oh my goodness.
So, but we went and visited Dad in jail.
To keep up appearances.
More than once in my life, I've been told that we're going to do this in the next 10 minutes to 2 hours or whatever it was, and a couple of ground loos laid down about what the story was, and then Dad couldn't tell me or our family anything else about it, but he'd tell us when he could, which generally meant after they made the case. And not as a kid, I didn't realize it, but more than once when we would go out to eat as a family to whatever restaurant, Crossroads Restaurant was a famous seafood place in town, which was one of them I do remember going to. He was really there observing somebody they were investigating. And it was a family dinner, yes. Dad and Mom paid for it, but he was working while we were there. My father was kind of like Wild Bill Hickok. He never sat anywhere in a public space, like a restaurant or anything like that, except in a corner with his back to the wall so he could see the whole room. And I grew up loving to, and still love to, just watch people and see what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I attribute some of that to growing up that way.
Yeah.
Father had a real story that he said happened to him once. And then he had a story that are my two favorite bootleg related stories. Dad said, you know, despite Elliot Ness and et cetera, and yes, he did know Elliot Ness, met him at least once, but bootlegging really, except for car crashes, wasn't as violent as the movies and all portray it. And his story that he said happened to him once is he was up in a North Georgia town in the middle of a week, walking down the street, Main Street, and he ran into a known bootlegger. And they got to talking, and they asked each other, how's the wife, and how's the kids, and what's going on, and et cetera. And then they said, okay, see you later. And so Dad asked the bootlegger, said, I asked him, you hauling this weekend? And the bootlegger said, yes, you chasing? Yes, well, we'll see you then. Because he said, if you caught him, said, any, you know, they'd go to court. And he said, and any bootlegger worth his salt could go out in the vegetable patch behind the house and dig up a Prince Albert can and get the money out to pay the fine. And there was not a whole lot of jail time.
Okay.
And seriously, not a whole lot of violence.
Yeah. 'Cause
my dad said he was always very glad that he never had to shoot at anybody in his entire career. He said he waved his gun around more than once to get attention, but that he never had to shoot. And then, like most law enforcement officers, he was always armed.
Yeah.
But the other story, he said he couldn't say for sure it was true, but the atmosphere was such at the time that it could be true. And he said supposedly in the late 1940s, a local sheriff and a federal agent, special agent with the U.S., used to be, it's now alcohol, tobacco tax, and firearms. But back then, it was just alcohol and tobacco tax.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And again, the federal government didn't care you made alcohol.
Just that you pay.
That you should pay your taxes on the profits you made by selling the alcohol. And that was... that's how they captured Al Capone. That's what they put Al Capone
tax
in.
Tax evasion.
Prison for was tax evasion.
Yeah.
But anyway, except for prohibition times, of course. But supposedly this sheriff and a federal agent were chasing a bootlegger in a cold, rainy night in the middle of the winter up in eastern Tennessee. And they were running him pretty close, but then they slid off into a ditch to the left side, the mountain side of the road, and got stuck in a ditch. Had they gone off the right, they'd have tumbled down into a valley and something bad probably would have happened. But they're thoroughly stuck. It's the middle of the night. No radios in cars in those days. And they're bemoaning their luck. They're going to be stuck out here for hours. This is a lonely highway. It'll probably be daybreak before anybody drives along to give them any help or anything, and they're outside the car in the dark, bitching and moaning, and they hear a car. They say, oh, a car's coming. And so they hear it coming up the mountain from down below. They'd been running downhill at the time of they got stuck. And they set a set of taillights backed around the curve. They could just see the taillights. And they heard the engine shut off, and they heard a door open. And out of the dark came a voice that said, you fellas okay? Yeah. What happened? Oh, we ran off in the bar ditch, and we're stuck. Nobody's hurt? No. Is your car drivable? Well, we think so. if I pull you out of the ditch, will you give me my quarter mile lead back? And they said yes, and the bootlegger backed up the mountain, hooked up a chain, pulled him out of the ditch. They all shook hands and got in their cars. And the two officers sit there until he disappeared around the curve, and then they started chasing him again. Now, Dad said, I can't say that story's true, but I can say the atmosphere was such it could very well be true.
Very gentlemanly.
Once attended in the federal courthouse downtown where the post office used to be. Once went to a trial with my father. Or at least Dad was testifying, and I had just never seen him in court. And I had, for whatever reason, maybe it was summer, and I was out of high school for the summer, so I went down and sat in court and watched my father testify. Several years later, I applied for Senator Talmadge's appointment to the Air Force Academy, and the year that I did, I ended up being second of everyone that had applied, so I got a very nice letter from Senator Talmadge that said that I did place second in the overall competition, which included intelligence tests, physical tests, medical tests, etc., by 3/1000ths of a point on whatever system they use for scoring. And since I was so close, that I was his first alternate, and if the guy that won declined the appointment, I would get it. Well, I later got a letter that the number one guy had not declined. He took it. So Senator Talmadge in that letter told me that since we were so close, if I wanted to be his appointee for the next year, he wouldn't even hold a competition. It was just mine.
Mm.
And so I sat down with the family and talked about it. And at that time, I was approaching being a junior at Georgia Tech and was accepted in Air Force ROTC, Advanced Air Force ROTC. And since the academies, at least then, I don't know about now, didn't accept any transfer credits, I would be looking at 4 more years.
Oh.
If I took the appointment. So with my father's help, wrote him a nice letter declining his offer.
Hmm.
Well, later in Washington, D.C., when visiting Mother and Dad between quarters at Tech, when they were up there, Dad said, "We ought to, since you've never met him personally, maybe we ought to go visit Senator Talmadge in his office and you can thank him." And I said, "Well, that's a good idea." So I went down to Dad's office at U.S. Treasury, and we walked down the street to the Senate offices and didn't have an appointment, just dropped in. And Dad just said, "Is the senator available?" And he was. So we went in and we were talking. He had his shoes off on his desk and had his pocket knife out, cutting off the inside front corner of the heels on his shoes. He said, "I just had them re-heeled today, resoled and re-heeled, and I always catch that corner in the cuffs of my suit pants, so I always cut the corner off." Well, I've done that ever since on any new pair of shoes. But anyway, we were talking, and as the conversation went on, and I thanked Senator Talmadge for offering the offer that I declined, he stopped and looked at my father and said, "Mr. Joyner, don't I know you from somewhere?" And Dad laughed and said, "Well, I believe the last time we were in the same room at the same time, Senator, I was testifying about a bootlegger that we captured on the forest on one of your farms, and you were sitting in the gallery." And he says, "That's right, that's where I know you from, and you convicted him." And Dad said, "Yes, sir, I did."
Wow.
But it wasn't that the senator was a bootlegger, it was just that a bootlegger was using some obscure corner of his land to set his still up.
That's wild.
My mother was, as I said, an ER nurse. She never worked full-time as a nurse in my lifetime.
Mm.
but she was always helping friends and families that needed nurses, whether in a hospital or, you know, in home. She was always a very caring person. Lived to be 2 months shy of 103. So I lost my dad at his age, 53, and mom kind of made the averages work out.
Yeah.
But when dad died, she moved back to Oklahoma to live with a widowed sister for, quote, 6 months until I get my feet on the ground, close quote. 24 years later, I got her to move back to Atlanta, and she lived the rest of her life here.
Did she move? Is that when she moved to Stone Mountain? Did she start? She started.
Yep,
when she came.
That's how Jan and I met.
Yeah.
I rented a house from a friend because I had talked mother into moving back to Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. From Oklahoma. This mm-hmm. was right after my brother had been killed in Sweden in a plane mm-hmm. crash, and so it was either find her an apartment or find someplace big enough for both of us to live. Mm-hmm. And I just was at a professional meeting with a fellow employee at our company, mm-hmm. but we were at a monthly professional meeting one night having dinner. And I asked him, they built a new house up in North Fulton County, mm-hmm. up by Crab Island. And I was asking Ray, how's the sale of the house in Stone Mountain coming? Yeah. He said, golly, Pete, we've had it on the market now for 9 months and just hadn't had many people look at mm-hmm. it. And I said, well, have you ever thought about renting it? This was just a dinner conversation. And he said, no, because renters never take care of a place. They don't take care of the yard. They'll tear it up. And are you interested? And I said, actually, that was a rhetorical question, but I might be.
What year was this, Bob?
1989. Mm. No, 1990. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, I might consider it. And he said, well, Jenny, his wife, is handling trying to rent the place, mm-hmm. So I don't have to take off from work or something. And you know Jenny, you've met her like you meet, I'd met her a few times. She mm-hmm. was the wife of a guy I worked with. Mm-hmm. And so we talked and arranged me to drive out over lunch one day and looked at the house and thought about it for a little while. And so, well, I'll get back to you. And then I think we met at the house to look it around twice and negotiate price and everything. And then I met her the third time to sign the lease. Mm-hmm. And so while we're there and I've signed the lease and all, and we're getting ready to leave, she said, may I ask you a personal question? I said, Jenny, you can ask me anything as long as you won't be upset if I choose not to answer. And she said, okay. She said, are you seeing anyone? And I said, no. She said, are you looking? And I said, no, I've just never looked. I just kind of figure it happens. And she says, well, I have a friend that feels that way. May I mention you to her? And I said, yes. No, that was the second time we met at the mm-hmm. house. The third time when we met to sign the lease, she said, well, I've mentioned you to my friend Janice Kilgore, and she said that I could give you her number. And so I went to rent a house and I found a wife.
Oh.
So I called her and we went out for Chinese dinner on our first date. Mm-hmm. And we dated for 5 years and been married for 24 now.
Mm-hmm. And you've lived in DeKalb County with you and Jan have lived in DeKalb the whole time?
Yes. I was, well, almost.
Sort
yes.
of, yeah.
I was living in an apartment with a friend. Mm-hmm. in Decatur, mm-hmm. and I lived there 88 through 90, and so that was DeKalb County, mm-hmm. but had a Decatur mailing address, mm-hmm. and then it was out off of Toco Hills, walking distance to Toco Hills Shopping Center.
Yeah.
And so lived there then, rented the house in Stone Mountain, and I lived in that house for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And Jan had a condominium over by Emory.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we married in 95, we looked for a house. The Stone Mountain House was in, by one quarter of a mile, was in Gwinnett County. Because you pass the Gwinnett-DeKalb County line on Old Rosser Road, drove one quarter of a mile, and that's where the house was in Gwinnett. So from probably November of 89, November of 90, until January of 89 until the summer of 95 when Jan and I got married and bought the house, summer, fall, I lived in Gwinnett County and then bought the house in what is now Dunwoody. It was unincorporated DeKalb when we bought the house because Dunwoody now is just a little over 10 years old.
Okay.
And the area was known as Dunwoody since forever. But bought the house in August of 95 and they've lived in DeKalb County ever since.
And how long has your neighborhood been having the Halloween? We just finished Halloween last week, so I was thinking about you and your neighborhood and how they have that Halloween. Well, Talk about that a little bit.
That was our 25th Halloween.
Yeah.
Because we moved in August, and then, you know, October of 95 was our first one. And so we've now had 25 of them. There's 60 houses on a dead-end cul-de-sac street. Zoning wise, we're one zoning rule bigger than what's called cluster homes.
Okay.
Our lots are slightly bigger than cluster home lots.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's 60 homes on the dead end street and a little side street.
Mm-hmm.
And one way in and out of the neighborhood. And they were, when we moved in, they were already, had been celebrating Halloween big time so much that they were already hiring off-duty DeKalb County policemen.
Mm.
For the last 10 years, we've hired off-duty Dunwoody City policemen. But for 60 homes, we, according to the various estimates from the off-duty policemen and heaven knows what, we average 45,000 trick-or-treaters.
Amazing.
Between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. on Halloween. We never reschedule it. It's always Halloween evening, despite the weather, despite school maybe being in session the next day and everything. We don't slide it because it's just too difficult. As you know, it's mostly Victorian homes. And at one time, I think 100% of the houses seriously decorated. It's now down. I suspect there were at least maybe as high as 15 out of the 60 that didn't participate this year. But we've always been very lucky. We have the off-duty policemen. We have neighbors. We take turns volunteering to patrol the neighborhood, wearing lit vests and things like this. Primarily to find lost parents. A kid never gets lost. The parents get lost. 2 years ago, we did have a unique one in that when Halloween was all over and after 9 o'clock when we herded everybody out of the neighborhood, we had a leftover kid. And actually, he had been left over earlier and he was lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so we always, anything found during Halloween, we take up to the entrance where the barricades are and the policemen are. And in this case, ladies took turns sitting with him. But when everybody was out of the neighborhood, we still had a kid that didn't belong there. He was about maybe five or six. And asked his sister's name, and he told us his sister's first name. He wasn't sure about his last name. Asked his mom's name, and that was Mama.
Yeah.
And ask what they looked like so we could try to find them while the people were still there. Well, my sister's dressed as a princess and my mom's a pirate. So that didn't help a whole lot with a few thousand people in costume.
Yeah.
But so we ended up, the Dunwoody police took him and said, we'll keep him at headquarters for a few hours. And then if nobody turns up, we'll have to call child services to come get him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems that a large family in two cars, many members of a family, extended family, had driven down from Gainesville. People come from a long way to see Halloween in our neighborhood. And when they all got back to the two cars, each one thought this particular little boy was in the other car, and it wasn't until they got home and missed him that they turned around and rushed back to Atlanta.
Oh, no.
And came in the neighborhood, and some were asking around, and we said, well, the police took him. So they went over and claimed him. They didn't file any charges. The police realized that it was just an accident. Somebody lost track of one.
A real life Home Alone scenario.
Exactly.
Right?
It was.
Wow.
But it may eventually wind down, but it was the two corner houses this year. One couple in one of them had been in the house for 6 weeks, and the other couple had been in the house for 2 weeks, and they both decorated like crazy and participated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've gone from in 24 years a neighborhood full of kids to almost no kids to a gazillion kids again.
It changes.
Just the natural change.
Yeah. We're at 45 minutes. I wanted to ask you if you obviously have a lot of experience working with helicopters, airplanes too?
Yes.
With?
And have a commercial pilot's license.
Yes. One story that stands out for me is your experience meeting an astronaut.
Oh, yeah.
So, will you tell that story?
That was funny. I was going through, this was September of 1970. We actually had moved back, my first wife, my daughter, who was just a little over a year old, and I had actually moved back to Atlanta when I'd gone to work for CNS Bank. And but I had to go back to Dallas to finish closing out our house there. And for many months, I had through AOPA, Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, it's many people who are involved in private flying and all, and some airline crews are members of AOPA.
Mm-hmm.
And through a program they had for a very nominal fee, you could go through the U.S. Air Force's high altitude training course. It's a day-long course, high altitude chamber and the whole bit.
Mm.
And the particular course I'd signed up for at the time, since I was living in Texas, was at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth. And so I didn't want to lose that opportunity. I think it only cost me $20.
Wow.
But so I was back out there to help close out the house, even though the family was now back here in Atlanta area. And remind me to tell you the telephone story.
Okay.
And so I went back out there and took the Saturday to go over to Carswell Air Force Base and take the course. Well, of the people there, we were all pilots, private pilots.
Mm-hmm.
Well, general aviation pilots, all different levels of certificates.
Mm-hmm.
And we teamed up. No two people in the class knew anybody in the class until we came.
Okay.
So just luck of the draw, I teamed up with a medical doctor from California who had come to Fort Worth to take the course because he was moving up into a high performance aircraft which could fly high enough that he had to worry about having an oxygen system.
Okay.
And being a doctor, he wanted to have the training. And so we're going through the course. I can talk hours on that course. It was fun. But anyway, we broke for lunch, and we just got to talking, and we were wandering around Carswell Air Force Base. And I said, well, talking to you earlier today on breaks and all, I realized you've never been in the military, so have you ever been on an Air Force Base before? Or have you ever been in military flight operations before? And he said, no. I said, well, you interested in going over to the tower and see what it's like? You can do that? I said, sure, let's go. So we walked over there, and as we're walking up to the control tower at Carswell Air Force Base, which is a building probably from before World War II, but definitely at least from World War II, if not older. In the typical military base, U.S. at least, nice small lawn out front with chains linked between poles and painted white. Everything is Byzantine to keep you off the grass.
Yeah.
Laying on the grass as we're approaching is a man in a white flight suit. He's laying on the grass on his back. He has a transistor radio playing country western music. His flight helmet bag, which is holding a flight helmet, he's using for a pillow. And he's reading a paperback Zane Grey Wild West novel. Well, as I get a little closer, as we get a little closer, I recognize a NASA patch on his shoulder. And then when we get close enough that I can read his name tag, I stopped and walked up to the fence and said, excuse me, sir. And he looked up at me and I said, I realize that you probably get these kind of interruptions at least 50 times a day, but may I shake your hand? Very gracious, very nice, jumped up, talked to us, said he has to fly often so he can continue to get flight pay. So he had flown up from Houston that day and was waiting for mom and dad to pick him up so he could have some mom's home cooking for lunch before he flew back to Houston. And that was Alan Bean, the fourth man to walk on the moon. So yes, I did.
Unbelievable.
I did meet a moonwalker.
That's good.
Who died just in the last year
did
or two.
He?
But very nice, very gracious. The telephone call.
Yes.
O'Keene, Oklahoma, 90 miles northwest of Oklahoma City in Wheat Country. In where the family farm is. My grandfather, my mother's father, was one of the original investors in a company called Pioneer Telephone. And basically what they did is they put the hand crank telephone system in for the town of O'Keene and the surrounding farms. Didn't connect anywhere when they first put it in. It was just, they were being very modern. And on the wall, the hand crank, the whole bit. Well, the telephone number, they were party lines. There were many families on each phone line. And so the telephone on the wall of the home place was its ring, because I don't know if you've ever been on a party line, but if you've been on a party line, you don't just get ring, ring, ring. You get a pattern of rings.
Hmm.
So you'll know it's a call for your house and not a call for your neighbor's house.
Hmm.
Because when the ring signal comes down the line to ring the bell on the telephone, it rings in every house that's on the party line. When I was young in Southwest Atlanta, we were on a party line here. We had dial phones, but it was still a party line.
Hmm.
But anyway, for the Slat farm, the ring was two shorts than a long. So if an incoming call was for the Slat family and the house and all the other houses on that particular party line, you would hear ring, 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 Mm-hmm. Ring, ring, ring. And how you accomplished that was how you turned the crank. Oh. So you'd go two rapid cranks yeah. was a short ring. Mm-hmm. So you go ring, ring, ring.
Oh.
If you were calling the slats from another phone on the same party line.
Yeah.
You'd pick up the receiver to see if anybody was talking.
Yeah.
And if nobody was talking, you could make a call.
Yeah.
If somebody was talking, courteous, being courteous, you wouldn't try to make a call. You couldn't. It just
right.
put noise on the line.
Right.
Well, also the flip side of that is you never had long conversations because somebody else might need to use the phone.
Mm.
Well, anyway, it was two shorts and a long was the slap ring. Well, in Atlanta, had bought a house after down in Fayette County after moving back from Texas and needed to talk to my mother. Well, at the time, mother was living in southeast Oklahoma in Swink, but she had gone up to O'Keene to visit relatives and sisters and brothers and everything. And I needed to talk to her about something. So I picked up the telephone in Fayette County and just dialed O for operator.
Mm-hmm.
The operator came on, and back in those days, it was still Southern Bell. Southern Bell operator. I said, I'd like to make a station call to Oklahoma. And she said, well, sir, you know you can now direct dial most places in the United States, and the rates are slightly less. I said, yes, I know, but I'd appreciate it if you'll help me.
What year was that, do you think?
We lived in that house from late 1970 until late 1973.
Hmm.
So it was in that
okay.
range. And I said, no, I know yeah. I can dial direct, but I would appreciate your help. Actually, you couldn't dial direct to the phone system
mm-hmm.
at O'Keene.
Mm-hmm.
It was the next to last crank phone system in the 48 states.
Wow.
One in Idaho lasted longer.
Wow.
Before it converted to more modern technology.
Oh, wow.
So since it was a crank system, you couldn't direct dial it, but I didn't tell her that. And so she said, what number are you calling, please? And I gave her the area code, and I said, 27R25. Sir? I said, trust me, it's area code, whatever it was. 27R25, that was known only to the operator in O'Keene, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Every house did have a unique number, but it was numbers and letters. Since you didn't dial it, it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the system they'd come up with. And so she said, okay. And so you heard her dial
mm-hmm.
before touch tone. And you hear a couple of rings, and then you hear Oklahoma City long distance, lady's voice, and she says, I have a station-to-station call for, she gave the area code, and 27R25, just a moment. And then you hear normal ringing, and somebody picks up, and the lady's voice says, O'Keene operator. And the young lady here in Atlanta said, I have a station-to-station call for area code 27R25. And she said, just a minute. And you hear ring, 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 many of them. And finally, the O'Keene operator comes back on the line and says, they don't seem to be at home. Did you say this was long distance? Yes, ma'am. Southern Bell long distance here. Bobby, is that you? And I said, yes, Miss Mabel, it's me. And she said, you looking for your mama? And I said, yes, ma'am. She says, they're not at home. They're over at Myrie's for dinner. You want me to ring them over there? And I said, if you would, Miss Mabel. And
so you knew the O'Keene operator?
I'd known her since I knew people. She was the only operator for the entire history of that phone system. And when it was upgraded to modern equipment, she retired. And literally the switchboard was in the parlor of her house
mm-hmm.
in town.
Amazing.
And she slept on a cot at night in her parlor, so in case there were emergency calls during the night, she could get up and hook up the plugs on the telephone.
Bless Miss Mabel.
And she said when she realized it was from the Atlanta area, it could only be Bobby looking for his mom. And I told my wife later, I said, she probably could have told me what they were having for dinner since she always listened in on calls. And my uncle, my Uncle Milo, bought, when they replaced and came up with the standard dial, wasn't touched on yet, dial telephones. Mm-hmm. He bought, he said, a barn full. I've known that. But he bought a whole bunch of the old crank phones.
Oh, yeah.
And they're made out of oak or walnut. I mean, they're beautiful wood, and people painted them and everything, but if you stain them. And he managed to sell quite a few of them. And now today, I'd imagine it'd be worth even more.
What a treat to be able to see one of those.
But DeKalb County, basically, I lived in Decatur and in Dunwoody, or Dunwoody area, unincorporated now, city of Dunwoody. And I jokingly say that we in Dunwoody upheld an old Southern tradition when we finally managed to get the city set up. We seceded from DeKalb County, so.
And with that, we'll stop the oral history. Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
That was fantastic.